From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A new investigation has found that over the past decade, more than $40 million taxpayer dollars have been spent on the maintenance and expansion of Confederate monuments and sites. A pair of journalists visited more than 50 of these sites and filed 175 open records requests to track public spending on Confederate memorials and organizations. Among them, the A.H. Stevens Park in Crawfordville and the Robert Toombs Home in Wilkes County and Stone Mountain in Metro Atlanta. Brian Palmer and Seth Freed Wessler are reporters for the Nation Institute Investigative Fund, which collaborated on the story with Smithsonian Magazine. Brian and Seth, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thanks so much for being here. Brian, I'm going to start with you because it was you working on a documentary project when you came upon this story. So what was that project and how did it lead to this investigation?
Well, it's really interesting because actually Seth and I were both working on stories about neglected African-American cemeteries, historic cemeteries. And we'd collaborated before, and we got to talking, and we found out that we were both concerned about why money wasn't going to these places and why some of these other cemeteries not too far away seemed to be doing quite well, pristine, whatever. And that's when we really decided to work together on this story because we found out in my home state, not home state, but where I live now in Virginia, there is an item in the state code that directs money specifically to Confederate cemeteries. And we thought that was strange, given that just blocks away, there are these historic places where formerly enslaved people and their descendants are buried that are just like jungles.
So how did you start gathering information for this story?
Well, we began sort of researching sites across the state of the former Confederacy to look into what the story was that was being told about the Civil War and about the Confederacy. And we spent a lot of time online reading about how particular Confederate sites articulated that history. And then we went on the road and we began visiting dozens of places that tell the story of the Civil War and of Confederacy and of slave of the Confederacy and of slavery, to really try to figure out what the story was that was being told at these sites. And at the same time, we tried to figure out how much money was being spent on these sites. And so we filed dozens of public records requests and called through tax documents and public records, public legislative reports to figure out what we're spending on these places. And after months of work, we published this story. And what we found is that Confederate sites, many of them, are telling a story that's really not based in fact, but grounded in narratives that defend the Confederacy and paint a picture of the history of slavery that's that really kind of whitewashes history entirely.
Well, I want to get to the story certainly, but the story that you did file together for a Smithsonian magazine, it's called The Costs of the Confederacy. $40 million taxpayer dollars over the last decade paid to upkeep and support these places. Can you give us a breakdown of the costs? What were they spent on?
Well, first of all, I would say that that's a snapshot. $40 million in the past 10 years, significant amount of money. But my real concern, in addition to how much is being spent now, is how much went into subsidizing these sites that present a narrative that either distorts or erases the enslavement of African Americans, my ancestors.
Beginning when, Brian?
So the first push of monument construction was really 1880s, 1890s. In Virginia, the Robert E. Lee Monument was dedicated in 1890. So this is where you see public funding as well as significant private donations going into the funding of these places. But Confederate memorial associations were receiving money to take care of cemeteries pretty much directly after the Civil War, which made sense. You had a lot of Confederate deceased soldiers that needed to be buried. The issue was that money, which started to flow in 1860s, 1870s, kept flowing. So the money to the cemeteries kept flowing. The money to Confederate veterans in states like Alabama simply got repurposed to fund these sites. So there are all of these really creative ways to keep these subsidies not simply for the initial purpose, which was graves or veterans, but to perpetuate this idea of a lost cause, of to venerate this cause. So people always say that, you know, the victors write the history, and that's actually true in this case, because if you look at the death, the killing of Reconstruction, and who came to power by killing Reconstruction, it was the folks who launched the Civil War. It was the former Confederates.
So now that money, is it going just to maintain these sites? Or we know that, you know, sites have been built up into the 50s and the 1960s. Or are they actually expanding any of them at this point?
Well, the sites that we're talking about, just to be clear, it's both monuments that we talk about often, you know, statues celebrating or venerating the Confederacy. And it's also sites that tell a sort of robust narrative about this history. In Georgia, there are a number of state and county-run parks where there's a full articulation of history, of the history of the Civil War, of Confederate leaders. And public money is going to support these sites to keep them running. In many cases, the public money is just going to keep them operating as they have for decades. And in some cases, these places have expanded. So we spent a lot of time on the road and in our story writing about a place called Beauvoir, which is Beauvoir, which is in Mississippi, in Biloxi, Mississippi. It's called the Jefferson Davis Presidential Library, which has always been a little funny to me because
he wasn't was not a president.
US
he was a president of the Confederacy.
Right, of a would-be nation. And that institution has received over $20 million in the last decade. And that money, which came from the federal government and from the state of Mississippi, has helped the place expand. So after Hurricane Katrina, like many places on the Gulf Coast, the Beauvoir, the estate where Jefferson Davis lived in the years after the war, was heavily damaged. And federal dollars went to Beauvoir to help it rebuild, to build historic buildings. But half of the $17 million that came from the federal government after Katrina and then was distributed over the years that followed went to build a new museum and library that really didn't exist before the storm and that tell a story about Jefferson Davis and about the Civil War that glorifies him, that talks about the sort of bravery of Confederate soldiers and, in fact, offers a story about slavery that proposes that Jefferson Davis was a benevolent slave owner. So when you visit this site, that's the narrative that you hear.
Well, and it's a very similar narrative that we found at, say, Toombs House, and they don't – Toombs House in Washington, Georgia doesn't get the same amount of funding, but it had a lovely renovation, again, substantially with public funding. And when I visited, I was the only person there on a very cold day in January, and I went through the entire house and saw the periodization of Mr. Toombs's career, but nothing on the walls about the defense of slavery and his role in enslaving people. So I asked a docent, so where is that? And she said, well, we don't have anything on the wall. But she handed me a WPA slave narrative by a gentleman named Alonzo Fauntleroy Toombs. And this gentleman was singing the praises of his massa and his enslavement. It was an interesting piece of documentation to deploy because we are used to having people deploy the so-called black Confederate and the loyal slave. But this is where I handed off to Seth, and Seth tracked down a scholar who gave us a very different story about Toombs.
Well, at both the Robert Toombs House and the A.H. Stevens State Park, both of which are in Georgia, both of which are owned by the state. And the tomb, in the case of the Toombs House, it's now run by the county. we hear this story about valiant and noble Confederate leaders, but really no narrative about their position on slavery or about people who these men held in bondage and who then escaped slavery, who escaped the places where they were held in bondage to try to seek freedom. Scholars have found histories in both cases of people who left, who escaped these plantations. Nowhere in the tours or in the materials on the walls or in the museums attached to these spaces is that story told. Instead, what we hear at the A.H. Stevens House, for example, A.H. Stevens was the vice president of the Confederacy, we hear about how well he treated the people he enslaved, how happy they were, how good their lives were. That's the narrative that's on offer. We don't hear, for instance, about Alexander Stevens' position on slavery. He's probably most famous among scholars and people who know anything about him for a fiery speech he gave defending secession and defending the Confederacy on the basis that slavery was just. And he said in this fiery speech that the Confederacy was based on the truth that, quote, the Negro is not equal to the white man, mm-hmm. that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This is what people who know anything about Stevens probably know. This is his most famous speech, and that's nowhere to be found at the museum. Instead, we get a picture of him as this sort of benevolent, valiant figure.
Yeah, and H. Stevens, the state park is in Crawfordsville, and he is he was, rather, the vice president of the Confederate States of America, former Georgia governor. You also point out that there is a figure that you found, Garland White, who escaped from Toombs' home just before the Civil War. We just have a minute. We're up against a break. But can you tell us quickly, what kind of story did White tell about the treatment of enslaved people on Toombs' plantation?
Well, that story, the story of that White tells is, and the story that's been documented about White is really about his life after the Civil War, his life trying to re-enter public life after the end of the Civil War. But Garland White escaped the plantation and then proceeded, after going to Canada, to try to recruit people to fight in the U.S. Army to defeat this insurgent Confederate government and to end the institution of slavery. I mean, that's the story that should be told about White. That's the story that historians have found about White. And we didn't hear that story when we visited a site where that man lived.
Well, we are hearing about the costs of the Confederacy. It's an article in the Smithsonian Magazine, and it came out of an investigation by my two guests, Brian Palmer and Seth Fried Wessler. They're reporters for the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And we're going to be back with more on their story and some audio that they heard from some of the sites that they visited. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Controversies over Confederate monuments have turned violent in several southern states, notably Charlottesville, Virginia. In some cities like Memphis and New Orleans, city officials have removed them. But a recent investigation finds that even if you don't support Confederate sites ideologically, your tax dollars pay for upkeep and even expansion. Brian Palmer and Seth Fried Wessler are my guests. They're reporters for the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Through visits and open record requests, they learned that places like A.H. Stevens State Park in Crawfordsville, Georgia, receive millions of dollars in public funding while often obscuring or conveying inaccurate information about the history of slavery. Their article, Costs of the Confederacy, is in Smithsonian Magazine. Well, I want to go back to Beauvoir because you got some spoke with some of the people there and got some audio. This is the Jefferson Davis Home and Presidential Library in Biloxi, or near Biloxi, Mississippi. You describe it, you know, centuries-old trees, manicured lawns, a tidy cemetery, a babbling brook. And during one of your visits, there was a large group of Mississippi school children along with Civil War reenactors. Here is one of them telling a version of Civil War history.
You see, a Civil War is where one bunch of folks tries to overthrow the government, the sitting government. And we weren't doing that. We wanted to establish our own country. We didn't care that the North carried on and kept going the way they were going. That was fine with us. Just leave us alone. Let us build our own country.
So that was the version of history that was given to visitors. You did speak to the then executive director, his name Thomas Paine, about what they were presenting there. What did he tell you?
Well, I think we spoke to the then executive director, and he gave us a good chunk of time one afternoon. We've also tried to speak to the current directors and other folks at Beauvoir who have not taken up our requests to talk. I mean, basically, the version of the Civil War is one that valorizes the individual Confederate soldier and venerates the leaders and obscures the enslavement of African Americans, but also the lived experience of African Americans. At Beauvoir, on the one hand, they'll tell you, well, our state mandate is to address the period that Jefferson Davis lived here. So that's post-Civil War, 1877 until his death in 1889. But on the other hand, we have this entire room devoted to the Confederate soldier, and then, of course, their annual fall muster, which happened just a few months ago in the fall. That's devoted to Confederate reenactments or mock battles that actually never happened. So what we hear is that once we press people on the issue of slavery or the African-American experience, one of the responses is, well, we don't have enough room on the walls to deal with that. And for me, that actually wasn't a good enough answer, because there's this strategy that folks who talk about the Confederacy in this lost cause way use. And it's how they deploy the folks they believe are loyal slaves, which they do at Beauvoir. There are a couple of panels on the wall that talk about two formerly enslaved people who came back to serve the Davises. Nothing wrong with that. What's wrong with that, the other side of that, or the context, there are the sins of omission. The 190,000, 200,000 African Americans who served in the United States colored troops, among them my great-grandfather. There are the half a million African Americans who liberated themselves, self-emancipated before the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And then if we're dealing with that period post-Civil War in Mississippi, there's a whole lot of lynching going on. And there was a whole lot of activity taking place under the banner of redemption, which was in 1890, the stripping of African American men the right to vote, which they won in the Civil War and during Reconstruction. So it is a consistent strategy that relies upon the reclaiming, really the co-opting of African American voices to this cause of a noble, glorious Confederacy and pre-war way of life. That's what I find deeply problematic. It's not one thing or the other. It's the fact that this has been a consistent strategy from about 1866.
Mm. Well, let me just play another piece of audio and credit also that this is from Reveal. This is the investigative radio program that we broadcast here on GPB, among other places. You asked a docent at Beauvoir what she could tell you about slavery.
I want to tell them the honest truth about it, that slavery was good and bad. It was good for the people that didn't know how to take care of themselves and they needed a job. And you had good slave owners like Jefferson Davis, who took care of his slaves and treated them like family. He loved them.
So, Brian, you were just talking about, you know, what was actually going on historically at the time that many of these memorials and monuments and sites were built. And the omission that the sin of omission, let's say, that they present. But this is actually presenting something altogether different.
Yes.
It is saying that, no, this was actually a good thing. You know, Jefferson Davis treated his slaves like family. What do we know about him, the president of the Confederacy? How did he treat his slaves?
So here we are. We're about to discuss whether or not Jefferson Davis treated his property well. These people were legally his property to dispose of, to manipulate, to violate in any manner he wished. So if he gave them an extra portion of fat back one day, does that make him a benevolent slave owner? There's no such thing. The owning of someone's body, someone's destiny, someone's labor, someone's life. So that's not something that I necessarily want to get into. I wonder why we don't talk about the enslaved people who left Briarfield, who left plantations such as, you know, the one that Jefferson Davis owned. I mean, there's a feature in Frank Leslie's Illustrated of enslaved people coming in from Jefferson Davis's plantation, and yet what they tell us at Beauvoir is this stuff about the 2-3 loyal servants who came back afterward. Again, those are true stories, but you're deploying, you are essentially repurposing those people's bodies. You are once again owning their bodies in death to tell the story that you want to tell and to omit the story of the tens of thousands, millions of people who self-emancipated, the hundreds of thousands in the state of Mississippi who did the same. That's the issue. So Jefferson Davis is more than a man. Jefferson Davis was the head, the president of a system created to defend the enslavement of other people because it was extremely profitable for particular folks.
Well, we have seen in the last couple of years, especially the more sort of, let's say, historically accurate museums that have been created. Just here in Savannah, the Telfair Museum, in a renovation, found all sorts of evidence of the lives of the slaves and slave quarters and are presenting that. More and more plantations mm-hmm. are presenting that. What would you want to see here at these Confederate memorials? Because as we know, there have been arguments for, well, give them context, you know, talk about what was actually going on contextually. Is the issue that you're seeing, like, whose context is actually created and presented?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a way to talk about this history in a full and thoughtful and historically accurate manner. There are sites across the country, across the South, where that's happening, where slavery is part of and at the center of the story of how plantations are discussed. Plantations were economic institutions that were built around the institution of slavery. It makes sense to talk about that. But in these spaces that we went to that are dedicated to Confederates, to the leaders of the Confederacy, in site after site, these figures, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, A.H. Stevens, and so on, are described as being benevolent to the people that they owned. And the people who were held in bondage in these sites described as being happy. It's a choice to tell history that way, and it does work. It paints the Confederacy as a benign part of history, as somehow separate from its basis in the defense of slavery. And that story, this story that sort of makes Confederate leaders, Confederates innocent of any wrongdoing, carries through. And we heard it over and over again in our time in these spaces.
Yeah, I'm wondering for you two. I mean, Brian, you're an African-American man. Seth, you are a white man. You set out initially visiting Beauvoir separately? I mean, did you look to get different stories as given the audience, a black man and a white man?
It wasn't a question of looking to get different stories. It was a question of me having lived 50-some-odd years in this skin and going to places where I knew and I found that people reacted to me based on my skin color before anything else. So my assumption was that we might have profoundly different experiences, and therefore we should have singular, as in Brian singular and Seth singular, experiences, and maybe compare notes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And what did you observe? Were there differences in the way that you were spoken to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, in general, when I talk to people in these sites, people who worked in these Confederate sites, people who were visiting, tour guides, they gave me this sort of full-throated defense of the Confederacy, defense of Confederate leaders, and a vision of slavery that involved claims that slavery was a civilizing and benevolent institution. The woman who we just heard, who was giving a tour of Jefferson Davis's home, where he lived after the war, said explicitly to me, right after a tour of the house with about half a dozen or eight white visitors to the space, you know, that slavery was both good and bad. It was good for people who needed essentially to learn how to work. I mean, I heard things like that, defenses of slavery that I think because I'm white, because I sort of blended in these spaces, there was a sense that they could say these things to me.
Well, I think yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to briefly return, Virginia, to the contextualization issue.
Yes,
because
yeah,
I think there's a great example here, Stone Mountain, right?
Right here, in Metro Georgia, Metro Atlanta.
Exactly. It is. If we look at it as a whole, it is now much more than simply a Confederate site, right? It's a public amenity. It's a park. It's this and that. And yet you have that giant mountainside carving, and then you have the Stone Mountain Memorial Association. Sorry, I haven't had enough coffee yet. Stone Mountain Memorial Association, which is still charged with protecting that Confederate monument. It is organized as a site to perpetuate Confederate history, a particular form of mythology, if you will. So the idea that it's great for jobs, it's all of this, it's all of that, and yet the central attraction of that place, they got the laser light show and all that other sort of stuff, is a monument to a history that did not occur. It's a mythological construction around which this park is built. So Stone Mountain now has about $13 million in bonds allotted for it. About over $200,000 of that money has been dispersed. Now they'll say, well, that's for a resort and conference center. Well, the money is still going to subsidize this site that is built around an object and an ideology that is corrosive to our democracy. And that's the point. Like, folks will say, oh, well, the black people, they're offended by Robert E. Lee statues. No, I am not offended. What I'm offended by is the lies that allow us to, or allow some people to perpetuate this idea that certain people are at the center of our history and other people, black people, Latino people, all sorts of people, are at the periphery. It's not true. It's corrosive. And that's the problem with this type of funding. It subsidizes a corrosive lie.
Well, I'm wondering about, you found that funds are often allocated by municipal and county coffers and have been for many years. That money has just been channeled in that direction to pay for these kind of monuments and sites. And officials exercise judgment on priorities in those counties. Do you think that taxpayers are aware of how these dollars are being spent? And as you say, by exposing this, maybe people will come forward and say, we don't want our money being spent on this. What do you think? What's the effect been so far?
Well, we've seen people really surprised that public money is going to these sites. One of the stories that Confederate organizations tell about these monuments and Confederate memorial sites is that they built them. They got up enough money, as one man said, and put up monuments, developed and built institutions to memorialize the Confederacy. I think there's a lot of surprise that there's been public money flowing to these sites from the very beginning, and that public money continues to flow. $40 million at least over the last decade.
Right.
We certainly missed money at the county and local level spent on statues and monuments. These are public spaces. Many of them are public institutions, state parks, and money is flowing to them. And if there's public money going to these institutions, then it would seem to us that there's an obligation to make sure that the histories being told in these spaces conform with the facts and don't try to tell a story of the Confederacy, of Confederate leaders, of Confederate soldiers that glorifies those people and denies completely the reality of the experience of enslaved people, of African Americans in these very spaces.
Well, there's so much more to talk about. A fantastic article you put together for Smithsonian, and I want to thank you both. Seth Fried Wessler, thank you, and Brian Palmer, thank you.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks.
They are fellows at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And again, they reported the costs of the Confederacy for the Investigative Fund and for Smithsonian Magazine. And you can read their full investigation in this month's issue. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. It's also a truth universally acknowledged that Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice is a story that still captures people's hearts 200 years after Austen was born. The classic tale has spawned numerous adaptations, from movies to zombie mashups. Playwrights Margot Melkon and Lauren Gunderson have extended the story with a Christmas spin.
You are the first person I have come to know who shares my interests.
I have no skill for words.
I find myself at ease in your company.
I also admire your laugh.
The play Miss Bennet, Christmas at Pemberley, is currently running at the Theatrical Outfit in Atlanta. And joining me in the studio is director Carolyn Cook. Hello.
Hello.
And you've brought along some ladies.
I have indeed.
Elizabeth and Jane Bennet themselves in the actual people of Jasmine Thomas, who plays Lizzie.
Hello.
Hello. And Jeanette Illich.
Yes.
All right. Who plays Jane. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, Carolyn, quick elevator pitch summary of Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice.
Go.
Okay. Pride and Prejudice is the story of Elizabeth Bennet and her long and arduous journey to realizing that she's actually in love with Mr. Darcy.
Well, nice summary. The play picks up a few years after the end of Pride and Prejudice, when Elizabeth and Darcy have been married and we're seeing the Bennet sisters all together at Pemberley's very, very grand estate, enjoying Christmas. Where do we find the characters at the start of the play?
Well, Mr. and Mrs. Darcy, a.k.a. Lizzie and her handsome husband, have a beautiful home, an exquisite place. And Lizzie has become sort of a sparkle in a very old-fashioned place, and she's making changes right and left and constantly surprising him, and she has put something in the middle of the drawing room that has never been there before, a very large evergreen tree. So this is the point
I'm clutching my pearls.
I know. This is the point in British history where they began to adopt the German custom of putting a Christmas tree in the house. And so this is all new, all very exciting and strange, and nobody gets it but Lizzie. It's a delightful beginning to the play. Her older sister, Jane, has been married to Mr. Bingley, of course, for a little bit longer than Lizzie and Darcy have been married, and they are expecting. So we have all sorts of changes coming.
Well, it all sounds quite quaint. And Miss Mary Bennet is the character that she's guilty pretty much of being sensible and not musically trained as a human being. That's just about the only thing that we can find that, well, let's say Jane Austen certainly picked up on that. Let's hear a little bit more from the production.
With bands of rosy hue.
You do extremely well, child. You've delighted us long enough.
Okay, so that's from the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
That is correct. Ultra popular.
But Mary's pretty much of a side character in this play. She's coming into her own as a woman. What is she discovering about herself through the course of the show?
Yeah, let's look at those 2 years from the end of Pride and Prejudice to the beginning of this play. A young person really, really, really comes into their own at the beginning of the show during that time period. And Mary is a young woman who has discovered a great deal about herself, and she has discovered that she has much greater ambition than simply sitting at home and playing the piano.
Hmm.
She is, I would have to say, musically trained in Pride and Prejudice, but not musically exciting. And I think that the person that we meet at the beginning of this play has become exciting and excited about a potential future, but she doesn't feel very hopeful that she's going to be able to live what she calls a large life, which is very important to her. She's brilliant. She actually is talented for the piano once she's left alone to play with it. And there's tremendous potential in this young woman.
So, Jasmine, you play Elizabeth Bennet, maybe Jane Austen's most well-known heroine. Mm-hmm. So is it daunting to play a character who's so well-formed in the minds of people and so beloved?
You know, I feel like it's actually really exciting because you have, especially for this show, you have all the given circumstances about Lizzie from Pride and Prejudice. And, you know, she's been actually a dream role of mine since college. And so I was really excited about that. And I don't necessarily think it wasn't scary or anything like that. I think I was just excited to put my own touch to Lizzie and then also give honor to the character that we all know so much about and that we love.
Why was it a dream role for you?
I just have always enjoyed the story of Pride and Prejudice. I also read it in high school and read Sense and Sensibility and just really, really loved the characters and how Jane Austen writes all of them. And after I saw the 2005 movie version of Pride and Prejudice, I was like, I love Lizzie Bennet.
Yeah. Is there any Elizabeth Bennet in you? Or how do your character and you as Jasmine spill over at all?
I would say so a little bit. I would describe Lizzie as fun and kind of like ever changing, and she likes to do what she wants to do, not necessarily in a bad way. And as she grows up and throughout the years and stuff like that, she is wise and isn't afraid to ask for advice anymore. And I think a lot of that lives in myself as a person as well.
And are you the person who would put the sparkling Christmas tree in the center of the room or whatever, sitting room, whatever they call it?
I think it looked good. I probably would, yes.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, she and Jane seem to see through. One of the great things I love about Jane Austen is all of the characters that she makes them so, you know, silly in their own mm-hmm. way and gossipy or nosy or prudish or whatever. And Elizabeth and Jane seem to see through it, Elizabeth especially. How about for you, Jeanette? You play Jane, who's pregnant with her first child in the play. How does this production, did it change your vision of Jane, or did you have one?
It actually helped me see Jane as a more well-rounded, full individual. I think for me, you know, Jane was always just this warm, you know, beautiful person, but you know, there wasn't a lot of depth there. And what this play has been able to do for me is open that up. Like, I can see Jane as a full, well-rounded character and a person.
And it's interesting to think of her becoming a mother, because their mother, Mrs. Bennet, is such a silly character in her own way.
Exactly.
What does the play touch on ideas of motherhood at all?
Well, Jane is very much the mother figure in this play. She, you know, rescues Lydia from herself, and she rescues Arthur from, you know, potentially making a huge mistake. And so I feel like she gets to kind of rewrite what a mother what her mother should have probably been mm-hmm. and what a mother should be in this instance.
All right, I'm seeing Carolyn nodding. Yes. You see the mother in this. What's the term?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that I love about it is that the play deals not only with motherhood, but with fatherhood. You know, Jane Austen wrote these beautiful male characters as well, mm-hmm. and Margot and Lauren, the playwrights, have picked up on that and created an absolutely exquisite little scene for two men, the husbands of each of these ladies, discussing what sort of father they would like to be and how daunting that prospect is. And I really love that the playwrights have included their perspective on the perils of parenthood.
So Jeanette mentioned Arthur. We haven't heard of this character, Arthur.
Arthur de Burgh.
Arthur de Burgh.
Arthur de Burgh. Well,
do you all speak an English accent? Accents.
Oh, when we're working, no, absolutely not.
Ladies don't work.
Never. Arthur de Burgh is a creation of these playwrights. The de Burgh family is in Pride and Prejudice. We have Lady Catherine de Burgh, who is the nemesis of Lizzie for a good long while, and a very, very stuffy, very pretentious character. And Arthur is her nephew. He is nothing like her, I can assure you. He's absolutely delightful. He's a bookworm and a science nerd and a geek and everything that I find completely charming. He's also played by the incredibly handsome Jonathan Horne, so that doesn't hurt. And he and Mary, I think, have similar needs. I think Mary is more aware of what's possible in the big world, and Arthur is more afraid of what's possible in the big world. And so the intersection of these two people is
smell
pretty
matchup.
Great.
Well, how does actually recentering the play on Mary's story expand our ideas about the Bennet sisters?
Well, there are five of them, four of whom are in this script. And I appreciate the fact that we open up what it's like to be the middle sister. Hmm. I'm a youngest sister myself, but I had a close view of a middle sister my whole life. And, you know, I think that person can easily get overlooked. And it's most unfortunate because in my case, my sister is brilliant and has a PhD and would never be happier than if she could curl up with a book. And that's so much like Mary, so much like Mary. And so allowing her the spotlight really opens up perhaps our eyes to see those who've been overlooked.
Mm-hmm. That's Carolyn Cook. She's the director of Miss Bennet Christmas at Pemberley, a play that's now on in Atlanta. Jasmine Thomas is also with us, and Jeanette Illidge. They're both in the cast playing Elizabeth Bennet and Jane Bennet, respectively. Jeanette, in fact, you apparently didn't really like Bingley when you first read Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
Now you're married to him.
Exactly.
How's it going?
Well, it's wonderful now. But when I first read Pride and Prejudice, Charles Bingley got on my nerves. I was irritated with how easily he kept getting swayed from one area to the next. I was like, make a decision, stick to it. But now in this production, and I love Charles Bingley. It doesn't hurt that Juan Unzueta, who plays Charles Bingley, is amazing. And him and I have a great dynamic. And so it's been lovely making discoveries with him as my husband, and also the comedic shenanigans that we can get into. It's wonderful.
When did you discover Jane Austen?
Oh, gosh, maybe eighth grade.
So Jasmine in high school. How about mm-hmm. for you, Carolyn?
Oh, I was in my 30s. I think I had tried to read Jane Austen when I was in my teens, and I didn't get it. These women are smarter than me.
No.
So,
No.
So interestingly enough, it took an audiobook. And I listened to an audiobook. If you remember perhaps the technology of cassette tapes, I listened to a cassette of Northanger Abbey when I was driving up and down the highway to visit my father, who was ill at the time. He got better, and I got to listen to Northanger Abbey. And I heard this brilliant British actress, whose name I can't remember, playing all the roles, and I realized, oh my God, Jane Austen is funny. I get it now. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't get enough. I just ate up all the rest of the books.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, the barrier to entry may be high because you were made to read it in middle school or high school mm-hmm. or something. And you mm-hmm. just think, oh, who are all these silly people? But maybe one of the big popularizers was the famous Pride and Prejudice from BBC's miniseries in the 1990s. We'll hear just a clip from that.
I might wonder why, with so little effort and civility, I'm rejected.
And I might wonder why, with so evident a desire to offend and insult me, you chose to tell me that you like me against your will, against your reason, and even against your character.
There she is, rejecting the proposal from Mr. Darcy. This was an extremely popular series. It mm-hmm. didn't hurt that Mr. Darcy wore a wet, puffy shirt, which you have to just see to imagine. But what do you think, you know, how people come to see Jane Austen, and what you have done in this production, one of your goals, is to make it not just old, stuffy, you know, drawing room white people, but actually reflect places where the play is presented. How do you do that?
Well, you cast the best actors you can find, and you set out intentionally not to place any barriers in their way. And I really credit Theatrical Outfit and Clifton Gutterman, the casting director there, for bringing me just a group of people who could pour themselves into this play. And I think, you know, we have a magnificent cast, and it definitely does reflect the population of Atlanta, and I think that's what we should be doing.
I have a friend who saw I didn't see it myself, but the Oklahoma that was recently presented in New York City, and I don't know where it was. I'm sorry, I'm not enough of a theater person to know that, but with an African-American woman and man at the front, and she said it completely changed her perception of everything. How does that, are you challenging those perceptions about how we generally think about this is what the story is?
I don't know that we're doing that as actively as that production of Oklahoma would, because I think one of the things that happens in American history is that we forget that there were African-American cowboys and that there were plenty of people of color who moved out west where they could have new opportunities and start their lives over outside of the umbrella of slavery. So that really speaks to something in our American history. So if you do that play that way, you're saying that. With this, I think we just said, these are universal needs and desires and loves. Yeah. And people, no matter where they come from, no matter what they look like, no matter what culture they grew up in, they fall in love. They are curious about science. They love a good novel. They flirt. They laugh. They eat dinner and they celebrate their holidays. And they have families and their families fight and the families make up. That's what life is. And that within the context of this story is happening with just, in my opinion, an exquisite group of actors.
And that we have them here, Jasmine and Jeanette. You both have sisters. I wondered if being in this play has made you think at all differently about your relationship with them. How about you, Jasmine?
Definitely. For one, it actually made me think about what being an older sister is, because I'm not one. But then it made the relationship with Jeanette really easy for me, because me and my sister are as close as Lizzie and Jane are. But yeah, definitely, it made me think about sisterly relationships.
Yeah, the same for me. I'm also the baby in my family. I have one older sister. I have a newfound respect for my sister and her endless patience with me as the baby. And playing Jane and getting to be the older sister has really been an eye-opening experience. It's like, oh, now I have to be the moderator and the peacemaker and all those things.
I want to play an older sister one day. That is Jeanette Ilitch, Jasmine Thomas, and Carolyn Cook. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley is running at the Theatrical Outlet in Atlanta through December 23rd, so you can still catch it. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Alex Kaslow is our engineer. Don Smith helps edit our audio, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. See you next time with On Second Thought.